EMS Garage is brought to you by EMS Manager, www.emsmanager.net.
You can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got GG on the phone. They're wanting to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. This is episode 24, and tonight we're going to talk about what makes a good medical director. And I have some of the industry-leading medical directors on the podcast tonight, along with Skip Kirkwood and Gary Wingrove. We have Dave Ross and Dr. Keith Wesley. And Gary, when your friend joins us, will you please let me, will you introduce him and let him and just tell us a little bit about him when he joins?
Absolutely.
Great. Well, I also wanted to talk, too. Apparently, there was a post on EMS United this week about giving 4 liters of oxygen via nasal cannula versus 15 liters of non-rebreather. And the docs on the call are saying they don't care. Just give oxygen. Is that right? Or am I crazy?
You're crazy, but we agree with you.
Yeah, I think those were two different questions.
you confused us there. So.
Sorry, I forgot to let you guys introduce yourselves. Dr. Ross, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks. The answer is yes and yes to your question, Curtis, on that, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. I think it really depends on what the clinical condition is, and if somebody's come up with new study that looks at outcome differences based solely on oxygen, I'm not aware of it, but that wouldn't be the first time that I'm not aware of new research. But otherwise, I don't really have a clear answer on it.
Okay. Mr. Skip Kirkwood? All right. Can they call you doctor since you have a JD?
Well, if you know, we were on a conference call in Germany, they would, in fact.
Really? Oh. Well, hello, doctor. Should I call you doctorin?
Herr Doktor.
Hello, sir. And apparently, do you care about oxygen or no?
I think everybody should have some oxygen. It's okay. Very good for them.
Generally, as a rule, you like 21%, and you're pretty happy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although there are mornings when, you know, an additional few percent probably aren't a bad thing.
Good point.
All with a liter of fluid, you know.
Good. Dr. Keith Wesley, sir, how are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. And I agree with Skip. You know, I think there's probably the only area I've actually seen some data is in the stroke patients where they've shown that that high flow O2, the 15 liters, there may be some evidence that that worsens stroke and that that group of patients probably only needs to be administered supplemental O2 if their SATs are less than 92%. And that data is somewhat questionable, but 2 liters of nasal cannula O2 is just standard for all patients, isn't going to be bad, and then 15 liters for your shocky trauma patients is probably fine. But again, I agree with Dave. I haven't seen any big free radical literature out there. I think that's probably, if there's anyone was talking about it, I think that's probably what somebody was talking about was 100% O2
There was a fair amount of noise a few years ago that I recall, but it was really talking about gross hyperventilation of brain injured patients and all the reasons why that wasn't good.
Yeah, but is that the option or is that the hyperventilation, right?
Yeah, and I don't think that's what, you know, we're not talking about the difference between a cannula and a mask there. We're talking about, you know, powered devices and hand-powered devices.
Okay. Oh, Dr. Gary Wingrove. You know, if they say it three times, it's true.
Oh, you have two more times to go then.
Yes, we'll make sure we make sure that's true. Hello, sir. Yeah, I always told everybody that every once in a while I get something in the mail that said Chief Montera, and I said, well, you know, two more times and it's true. Well, you know what? Now I'm Chief. So
hey,
all right.
Kind of scary. It's kind of scary how that works. So
congratulations.
Oh, yeah, it's great. So Gary, do you? I'm not going to be a doctor though. You guys, and you guys make way too much money. Oh wait. Right. Anyway,
That's okay. You may have heard that there's a guy named Obama who's going to change the healthcare system.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They're going to make a lot.
Yeah. Well, I'll be making less than laborers.
Yeah. Well, that was kind of crazy because in that, Gary, you know a little bit about this. This week there was legislation introduced about the docs getting more reimbursement. Really?
Yeah. There was something about ambulances getting more reimbursement too.
Yeah. I think that got shot down.
Well,
it's not introduced yet, but it will be.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was going to say there's one came out kind of as fact today, I think, from AAA.
Yeah, they've got about a
6% raise.
They've got the people lined up to do the introduction, and it'll happen soon.
Cool.
But there's no bill number yet.
Hmm. So you're
this is a federal bill, Gary?
Yes.
Is that part of the stimulus, or is it just part of the budget?
No, it would be for Medicare.
Oh, okay. Well, good times. Well,
hey, Chris, can I tell you a little oxygen story, though, since we were talking about oxygen therapy? You might find it interesting. And on the other hand, you may not, in which case I'll just be boring the heck out of you. But there was a time a few years ago when I was asked to rush to the World Arena, which is kind of a local venue down here in Colorado Springs, to respond to a sick band member of Aerosmith. So Aerosmith was in town for a concert, and apparently they were not going to go on stage because the way I got it was one of their band members was ill, and they were of course too sick to be transported from the World Arena to an ER. They needed somebody to actually go down there, and so I went down there and I was ushered into the dressing room and everything, and there I am with the band, and I'm saying, okay, who's sick here? And they go, well, we all are. And I said, you're all sick? This is in June, you know, so I'm thinking carbon monoxide something, you know, I mean, I don't know what, or what it is that they've been smoking and stuff, but you're all sick, are you guys just having altitude problems? Because it's about 6,500 feet above sea level here where we live, and I'm figuring maybe, you know, they put on a pretty big show. Maybe they just need oxygen. You know, that's what I was thinking. And maybe that was the problem. And I said, so, well, what's the problem? Well, we just don't feel that good. We can't go on. We need our stuff. And I said, you mean oxygen? And they said, no, we need vitamin B12. We need B12. We can't go on without B12.
Oh.
And literally, the people are out, you know, stomping their feet waiting for the concert to start. So we had to actually send one of our EMS supervisors back up to one of the hospitals and get them B12 because they absolutely refused to go on. And the rest of the time I was hanging out behind stage during the whole concert, again with oxygen, thinking that, you know, at some point they might need oxygen, but it never happened. It was just the B12 thing. Of course, in the old days with Aerosmith, it used to be other things than just B12.
Who's playing the bongo drums?
I think that's Dr. Wesley. We can hear him typing. I was just going to
Sorry.
It's good rhythm for the background of the story about Aerosmith, you know. It's like, right, yeah, exactly. Right.
I was waiting for him to say Narcan, you know, but
Narcan. Well, that would have been that's the chaser. It's B12 Narcan chaser.
So that was one of those times when I thought oxygen was going to cut ride to the rescue, but it flopped and it lost to B12. I don't know if other people have run into that, but I haven't seen B12 shots given except to like little old ladies in old family practitioners' offices, but it kind of made a resurgence a few years ago here.
Well, let me ask. Okay, so here's my annoying thing of the night. I get somebody, they're obviously in respiratory distress. You know, their O2 sat's in the toilet. I get there, I correct them, I give them nitro, I give them morphine or fentanyl, whatever the drug of choice is that day for their chest pain. I reverse all the bad things going on with them. I get their oxygen saturation up, and lo and behold, I roll into the ER, and what's the first thing they do? pull them off, the oxygen. Oh, let's just see how they were. Not willing to take the idea that, well, they were really bad in the field. Why don't you just take our word for it?
Well, or worse, you roll in and they want to get with a COPD or and they want to get a blood gas.
Yes.
So let's take him off the O2 so we can get a blood gas, because heaven forbid they can't calculate the AA gradient if they're on, you know, 100% O2.
Yes.
Blood gases are ordered by people who have never had a blood gas drawn on them. So right. I think that's a big part of the problem.
I think everybody ought to come with an art line so we could just draw it at will. No,
well,
okay,
you know, that, Chris, that kind of goes to just a general philosophy, and I think that, you know, I realize it's not always possible, but to the extent that a physician can meet a crew and kind of get the lowdown directly from people, especially people that you know and you work with and you've trusted in the past, you know, and they tell you the room air sat was X or their sat on their normal oxygen was X, I mean, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Once you hear the story and you realize, you know, what was going on out there, then it doesn't have to be repeated. You know, I will sometimes later, 3 or 4 hours into somebody's emergency department stay, when we've treated them, and I think they might be ready to go home, put them back on whatever their oxygen level is, if they're on oxygen at home, or on room air if they're not, and see how they fly, because I'm thinking about discharging them. And I might get them up and walk them a little bit, but that's not until we've kind of tried to figure out what's going on and how we need to come about treating them. But again, I'm thinking if you talk to the crew when they come in, and I'm speaking as an ER physician now, and kind of get the lowdown on what happens, you can save yourself as a physician some of those hassles and save the patient a little bit.
Oh, I agree.
And keep the respiratory terrorist away from the patient.
Nice.
I had an amusing discussion over lunch today about the respiratory therapist, without the permission of the physician supervising the post-successful resuscitation activities, pulled out the King Airway with not so much as a word to anyone and announced, well, you can't have a King Airway in a person with a pulse. Oh. To which everybody else in the room said, gee, we do it all the time. And some of them go home from the hospital.
Oh, gosh. Oops.
Yeah. 10-4.
So what happened after that, Skip? I mean, what did they do about that?
Maybe the apoplectic event that the physician suffered. I think that's yet to occur. He was decompressing over lunch.
Yeah. They probably gave the King Airway to the respiratory therapist in the other end.
I was thinking the proctological consequences of King Airway insertion.
Excellent. Well,
minus the K-Way.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, whatever makes the pain more... at least that respiratory therapist will remember that for a long
probably.
Time to come. Yeah. So I wanted to talk, since we're going to have doctors galore tonight, I really wanted to talk about this idea of what makes, and Dr. Wesley, you actually wrote the article, so maybe you can introduce it a little bit, but what makes a good medical director, and, you know, what should we be looking at? Because I see all kinds of medical directors. I do some consulting on the side for a lot of places in the state here, and I see all kinds. I see the ones that just show up. I see the ones that you never see. In fact, there's a case here in Colorado just very recently where the medical director had been dead for 3 years, and nobody had really said anything about, oh, yeah, maybe we should find out who this guy is, and it's just kind of one of those things that was status quo for so many years, they just let it go. You know, they just went, oh, that guy's our medical director. So, Dr. Wesley, do you want to introduce your article? Yeah, it's kind of scary.
Well, actually, it was a review of the, you know, the LEADS project, and all right, help me out, guys. What does the LEADS project stand for? From the National Registry.
It's longitudinal, something to do with EMS people study.
Close enough. But every year when you do your National Registry renewal, there's those questions on the back that you have to fill out. I think this year they're asking, are you fat and do you smoke and do you work out? Anyway, in 2004, they asked a set of questions about when was the last time you saw your medical director? Was it within the last 3 months, 6 months, a year? And in what capacity was it? Were they on the? Did you see them on the scene, participating in your education, one-on-one interaction, reviewing a case?
Getting your butt chewed.
They really didn't get down to that specifics. I wish that they had. They reported this out, and interestingly enough, two-thirds of those that reported, and that was almost 40,000 EMTs and paramedics. This is from the 2005 renewal cycle. Had some interaction with their medical director within the last 6 months.
Well, praise the Lord.
Yeah, and so that was that was really the sum total of the report. Now the question, quantity versus quality here. And we won't, no jokes aside there. So the question is, what really constitutes medical direction involvement? One of the things that I brought out, of course, one of the issues with the LEADS project, in which, my hat's off to the National Registry for asking these questions, but... there's a little bit of selection bias in that what services maintain or require national registry. Is there, are nationally registered EMTs and paramedics, are they a different subset of EMS than the rest of EMS in the country?
Oh, well, probably, because one of the characteristics of the states that don't use the National Registry for any purpose is that they don't want to charge fees. At least logically, that correlates to me with states who are turning themselves inside out to maintain a volunteer workforce.
Right. So how many states? There's very few states that require National Registry be maintained, and we know that there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 600,000 licensed EMTs and paramedics in the country. It's hard to draw broad strokes out of the reporting of 40,000, because I frankly, two-thirds actually saw their medical director within the last 3 to 6 months. My experience traveling across rural Minnesota is most of those services I come across couldn't pick out their medical director in a lineup at the post office.
Can I ask, is it because they're not paid? Do you think it's because medical directors aren't paid generally by small services, or is it what is the mentality behind that? Really, it's their butt hanging on the line.
I think there's two ways you can cut that. There is the group that could have more medical direction if they wanted it, but they intentionally keep their medical director at arm's length, and the medical director allows it. And there's the you get what you pay for part of the equation. And, face it, emergency physicians, although, very well compensated and well respected, in large part, work by the productive hour. And if you're going to do an hour's worth of work, it's worth a chunk of change to do that hour's worth of work seeing patients in an ED, as opposed to volunteering your malpractice insurance and liability exposure to a bunch of people out of the goodness of your heart.
Yeah, I would break it down into a third group, and that is just simple ignorance and neglect. You've got
I'll buy that.
The services that want a more active medical director and simply don't have access to someone who has an understanding of the awesome responsibility and value that they could be. And, you know, we talk about emergency physicians, but, you know, the realities are that 80% of EMS medical direction in this country are not provided by ER physicians. They're provided by family practice physicians and PAs. It's only in the suburban and larger communities that it's emergency medicine physicians. Even in smaller towns, their family practice physicians or surgeons, they may be working and pulling ER duty in the local hospital, but it's usually small critical access hospitals where they're actually running their family practice clinic and then also pull, you know, hours over in the ED.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. I think that, you know, part of the problem, too, is that Steve Barry and I had a conversation, you know, for those who may not know on the podcast. Steve does cartoons, is well known. He's from Colorado, our area, is nationally known, does a lot of cartoons and gems and other publications and has his own books. And we talked because he was preparing a lecture for the current EMS Today conference coming up in Baltimore, in part about, you know, why medical directors decide to do EMS or get into it and why they don't. And he had a great cartoon to kind of emphasize his view, which is it shows a group of physicians in white coats standing around in a circle, and the caption says, picking a medical director, an EMS medical director. And they're all holding like ET tubes, and the guy who draws the short ET tube is the winner. And there's a couple of goofy looking EMTs in the background, kind of grinning, you know. And I think he has a point. You know, I mean, my partners, the majority of my partners, and really in our competitive hospital here in Colorado Springs, they don't want to do this stuff. You know, they're really not interested in doing it, and. That's not everybody, obviously. There's a small subset of people who really do. But you're starting from a pool of physicians who really don't have a great interest. And then I think you add, you know, the point that Chris made earlier, which is the pay issue is the factor. I'm actually just looking at my email right now, and I'm looking at a blog for medical directors and people that are involved in EMS on the American College of Emergency Physician EMS section, and this guy is writing, he's talking about EMS medical direction for community colleges, and he's not talking about all EMS medical direction, but he's talking about community college EMS medical direction, and they're talking about the pay, the reimbursement, and he's saying things. He says, you know, I've been involved in emergency medicine for 30 years, and in the good old days, I used to do a lot of this stuff for free, in EMS to advance the profession and advance EMS. But now I'm being told I'm not worth as much as, say, an accountant. And why is that? And yet I'm still holding all the liability. So I think in some circles that pay is an issue. And but I do think you have to find the physician who is interested in doing EMS. And I when I first read Keith's article, I kind of got excited. I thought, well, I spend a lot of time, you know, with my agencies. I'm probably not in that group, you know, that where an EMT can say they haven't seen me in a few months. And then I started to think about my small volunteer agencies, which I have out near Kansas. And the last time I was out there was probably 6 months ago. And, you know, I do their QA through the mail and stuff and send it back to them. But I've been trying to get out to one of my agencies. I've been trying to look on my schedule to drive out there to spend the 2.5 hours to get out there and back each way for the past 4 or 5 months, and I haven't been there. So I was kind of euphoric at first when I read it, and then I thought, oh, this is kind of depressing, because I wonder how many people in my volunteer agency's ways out there would not know who I am, or, you know, would complain, hey, I haven't seen my medical director either. So, you know, I look at it from both sides of the fence.
Well, I also want to talk to and maybe touch on the idea of... Whoa, Dr. Ross, I'm hearing myself in your voice. Also talk on the idea of what qualifications should a medical director have. And Gary, you have a new guest with us. You want to introduce Dr. Hankins and maybe tell us a little bit about him?
Dr. Hankins is one of our medical directors. And Mayo, of course, is a university, and so many things operate by committee. And so Dr. Hankins is one of our medical directors, along with Dr. Roger White and Dr. Dave Claypool and others. And he is part of a unique system in southeastern Minnesota where medical direction is done in a multi-county area. And I thought it would be cool to have him spend a little bit of time and kind of talk about that. But one of the things I wanted to mention was you've heard me talk about Dr. Hankins before. When we did kind of the recap of the NTSB hearings, I mentioned that Dr. Hankins was one of the panelists for that. And I just wanted to take a second while he can actually hear it to say that, you know, there are some times as you go through life that you become really proud of the organization that you work for. And I was really proud of Dr. Hankins and the organization that I work for in hearing him do his testimony and respond to questions at those NTSB hearings. He did a really great job.
Thank you, Gary.
You're welcome.
Welcome, sir. So we're talking about this idea of what makes a good medical director, and what in your mind makes a good medical director?
Well, as probably everybody in this call knows, EMS medical director gene pool is very small. So I think dedication is probably the big thing. And once you get EMS in your blood, once you get in your blood, it never goes away.
Do you think it's, I'll throw this out for all the docs, is it the doc that comes alongside and really wants to mentor people, or is it the doc that is the dungeon master and wants to come in and flog everybody? Which one's better? Because I've had both.
How about a doc who thinks of EMS as his medical practice? You know, I have represented an agency. It's fortunate to have. We have a full-time, professional, board-certified, fellowship-trained EMS medical director. And one of the things we say about Dr. Myers is he's got the largest medical practice in the state of North Carolina. We saw 72,000 patients this year through his crop of physician extenders that take care of the citizens of Wake County. What makes a good one? Wants to be there, thinks it's important, knows the art and science, and puts forth the effort to make sure that the patients that his practice takes care of get good medical care.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
Well, and Dave and Dr. Wesley also talked about the idea that a lot of the EMS physicians in the United States aren't ER board certified medical directors. Do you think that that has to be a qualification for a good medical director, or do you think that, or do we agree with Dr. Hankins that it's really just somebody that has an interest in EMS and really wants to do good and really wants to, you know, you get it in your blood and you go from there? I don't know.
I guess I think it depends on what you think of EMS. So, I mean, it's purely opinion driven. But, you know, if you think of, you know, as I do, that EMS is the practice of medicine delivered in vehicles with blinky lights on them, I really like having somebody whose focus is on doing EMS. Now, it's probably not practical for a service that doesn't do a huge volume to have a full-time medical director. But there's probably a lot more opportunity for full-time medical directors than there are medical directors interested, trained, and focused on that particular subject matter.
Interesting. Well, I
would just say that, you know, yeah, if I may, you know, I think I'd agree with Dan that first and foremost, you have to have somebody who's really interested in it, and those people are rare birds. Beyond that, I don't think the specialty is critical, because if you're interested, you're usually willing to listen and learn as well as to provide some teaching. And, you know, one of our best medical directors in the state of Colorado is a neurosurgeon, Dr. John Nichols. I mean, and I don't think anybody on his service or in the state of Colorado would trade him for anybody else in EMS for what he's done for this state and, you know, for what he does for his agencies. They love him. And, you know, he does a great job. But first and foremost, he's interested in what he does. And I think that's the prime criteria. And the specialty is somewhat secondary. I think we've all seen family docs, emergency docs, or surgeons, you know, in those roles who haven't done too much of a very good job at all. So it's really not critical on the specialty side. I think it's more the interest side.
So the question is, do we actually, as an industry, take it upon ourselves to, for lack of a better term, rid ourselves of the phantom medical director?
Well, I think that's a good question, but is it that we're moving away from this old idea of physician advisor that was just somebody that signed off on protocols and was, you know, they just thought, well, EMTs just are starting IVs and giving oxygen on the way to the hospital. I really don't know what they do, but I sign their protocol every once in a while. To this idea of truly medical director, where they're coming in and they're looking at patient care and things like that. I have a feeling that as time goes on, that people in your industry, docs, that really are looking at this idea of medical care and health care that we're providing, and they want to be a part of that, versus this old idea of just a physician advisor that, you know, it's the local doc that, you know, it was the best we could do at the time.
Well, the state of Colorado has moved away from the term physician advisor, which I always hated personally anyway, because I really don't view myself as just an advisor. You know, I see myself as integrally involved in what my agencies do, and I see myself as ultimately responsible medically for what the agencies do. And as such, I don't think that I'm an advisor anymore. And the state here has changed that term officially from physician advisor to medical director, which is what it really ought to be. And I think that that's what we should be striving to do. And there are going to be places, obviously, around the state and around the country where you aren't having people buy in to this from a physician standpoint, no matter what their title is. And and hopefully we can eventually put that aside. But you know, I do it in part because I think it's a lot of fun. And I really admire my crews. I think they do, I see repeatedly some of the great work they do. I see some of the poor work that they do. But, time and time again, they go into very, very tough situations, and they do some amazing things. Some of it's recognized, you know, publicly, and much of it isn't. But I appreciate what they do, and I think it's an important service for me and the others that I work with to try to keep them at the top of their game, because they're taking care of the patients.
I agree with what Dave's saying, and I guess from my perspective, it's been one of the issues that I've been trying to deal with here in the Midwest, and I think that it comes back to education, and it's not something that you can regulate away or regulate out or regulate in. You have to educate awareness, and it's kind of like what we were talking about during the leadership podcast with safety, we really have not been very good about providing medical directors some avenues of education to help them understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing and how to do what they're supposed to be doing. And so how can we criticize them when they don't do what they're not doing if they don't know what they're supposed to be doing? You know what I'm saying?
Right. You know what's very cool is the our medical director here changed right after I started my job. And I gave him a radio and said, hey, you want to come to a call? Anytime you hear something that interests you, you come. And you would be surprised at the reaction to the crew. That it's like all of a sudden the medical director is just standing there. It's like, oh, wow. And he doesn't butt in and he doesn't insert himself or anything like that. He's just there to see how everything's going. And if you have a question, I'm here too. And I really encourage that. And maybe it's this idea that it's also part of the system. You have to have the system leadership bought into the idea that the medical director is truly there to help out with direction of medical care and not just a figurehead that signs a document.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you want to make them more exciting? Give them a vehicle. I realize when you're talking about Range Rovers, Chris, that's a lot of money.
We don't have Range Rovers.
But it really adds an interesting dimension to the system when everybody in the system knows the medical director or the associate medical director now, who is a former paramedic emergency physician, is, you know, very well may turn up at any scene and likely will. And if I'm there, I'll put him to work.
And Dr. Hankins, I hear that maybe you might do something like that? Or no?
Yes. As Jim Page once said, the only true QA for macro directors is to be at the scene. Hmm. And I probably don't go as many as I used to since I've gotten older, but only because of time, more than less. But I still enjoy going to scenes because the ultimate question for an EMS doctor is, when do I get my badge and red lights?
That's great. So tell us about your system. How does it work? Do you get a car? Are you full time with your agency? Are you full time with Mayo? Help me out with that.
His license says the same as mine, but it's Minnesota and mine's Wisconsin.
EMS doc.
That's right.
Nice.
Well, I wear double hats. I'm medical director for the helicopter and ground ALS system that Mayo has in 11 cities around Minnesota, but also I'm medical director for the Southeast Minnesota EMS Consortium, which is medical direction for BLS services and first responders. And about 13 years ago, we said, you know, the small ambulance services, the volunteer ambulance services, aren't getting medical direction. There was an apocryphal story in Minnesota that someone's medical director had been dead for 2 years. You're talking about phantom medical directors. So we decided, four of us got together at a kitchen table and said, wouldn't it be great if we could provide medical direction multiple services that would extend the physician's time and give them what they need? So basically we formed a consortium which now has 35 basic services and first responders. And I think we have 11 medical directors, but the key point is we have extenders, physician extenders. So we have paramedics in the region, which is 11 county region in southeast Minnesota, paramedics and flight nurses to actually go out and do the training. We offer these five training sessions a year, so it comes out to be about every month. And we do key lectures for them. We do cardiac arrest, we do trauma. We do just a variety of QA things. We do run reports for them. And then we also keep all the records for the EMS Regulatory Board of Minnesota. So we keep their training records, which then is much more easy for them to submit when they go for their license renewal. So that's in a nutshell what we do. And the paramedics and the flight nurses get paid, and the docs don't. I mean, it's basically a volunteer thing like most all else EMS that we do.
Well, that sounds great. And do you, and I take it you get to go out on, like you said earlier, you get to go out, or at least you used to. Do any of your partners, or do they go out on the calls and take part in the calls?
Well, I've got some up-and-coming youngsters who are interested in doing it. And I think it will transition to that, since I'm going to probably retire in 5 years or so. But yeah, I mean, there are people interested in EMS. And I think one of the things that's going to change the whole landscape is the IOM report. and I'm sure you guys have talked about that on this podcast, but you know, once you get professionalization of EMS macro direction, and I think it's going to be like emergency medicine, though, you won't have a lot of fellowship-trained EMS fellows out doing rural EMS. It's going to be like emergency medicine, which is they're going to concentrate in the urban areas first because it's a lot busier, and then gradually over the next 50 years, some long after I'm gone, they will transition out across the country, I think.
Hey, Dan, the only thing I would change in your comments is that you, in the current economy, you'll probably be retiring in 10 years, not 5 years. So
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah. I'm like, did you see the Tao today? Come on.
No, my wife and I are planning on living in a dumpster eating cat food.
Oh, well, in that case, you could retire tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So,
go ahead, Chris. Sorry.
No. Go ahead, Dr. Dave.
I was just going to add, and this is actually, you know, I think it's a relatively small point, and I don't know how many states do this besides our state in Colorado, but we touched on the pay issue a little bit, and I do think that certainly that's not the only issue. A lot of us, you know, volunteer our time or work for very little money in certain circumstances because we want to do that. And I don't, just like you have volunteers working, you know, on EMS crews and on ambulances, you do have a number of physicians working for nearly nothing in certain circumstances to help communities out. But having said that, the money is an issue. It's sort of an undercurrent behind this, although I don't think it's going to replace. It doesn't generate interest if interest isn't really there. But in our state, in Colorado, one of the things that I think is really kind of screwy is the hospitals tend to pay emergency physicians who are interested for the EMS medical direction that they are willing to provide, especially to agencies that are going to bring patients to those hospitals. And so you have sort of an un-American system. For those physicians who are getting paid, it's a variable amount of money per hour, and the actual end users of the physician services, the EMS agencies, aren't paying. And so they don't really care in our state a whole lot, from a financial end, whether the medical director shows up and teaches or not, or whether they get trained or not from a financial standpoint, because they're not paying the bill. And so it's a third-party payer, which is really bizarre, actually. And I think a healthier way to do it would be, and I realize there are financial constraints for EMS agencies, but I think in the longer run, you know, the EMS agency actually paying the medical director, if there's money involved, is a more direct way to assure both sides are doing their part.
Dave, that's an interesting point, because there is a state in the country where that actually is being litigated, that may be a violation of the Stark legislation for a kickback.
Wow.
That you're providing a service, you're providing a service to induce bringing patients and not charging for that service, and that might be a violation of Stark.
So let me ask this: What should I be, if I'm an agency manager and I want to pay a medical director? What's a fair wage per hour? What's a doc's time worth?
Boy, that is a great question. It really is, and I think it'll be interesting to hear what Dan and Keith have to say. I think it's very variable, and I can tell you without going into specifics. I some people on this podcast may know that I work for an AMR operation here in Colorado Springs, and obviously AMR has medical directors all over the country wherever their operations are. And I can say that within AMR, the medical directors don't really know what the other medical directors are earning per hour, per month, however those people are being paid. So even within the company, there's really no comparative benchmark, you know, that you can bounce off and to know what you should be asking for or getting. And that's certainly true, I think, across the state, AMR or not AMR, and it's true across the country. No one really knows. I know that I work for less per hour for AMR, but I work for many more hours than I do for my hospital paid hourly. And our group, our ED group, recently discussed its administrative rate, what we were going to charge, not just for EMS, but, you know, some of my partners do other administrative duties. Somebody's the medical director of the emergency department. You know, some people are involved in high-level committees in the hospital, and they all get paid, you know, at a certain hourly rate. And our group decided that, and we get paid with not all hospital money, some of it supplemented by our own, you know, billings, but they wanted to go to 85% of the clinical hourly. Now, the clinical hourly is what we would earn, everything rolled in, you know, for an hour of seeing patients in the emergency department. That is the most amount of money that an emergency physician really can be earning. And if you take 85% of that, that's a pretty hefty hourly. And the question is that really worth it? Say for being an EMS medical director or any other administrative position, is that really worth it? You know, and it depends on who or what you compare it against. And I don't know the answer to that, really. There are times I feel a bit guilty about it.
My attorney costs $320 an hour, so anything less than that, I'm pretty happy with. I mean, really, is it 100? Is it 200? What per hour is a good hourly rate?
Well, we did survey of state medical directors, and the salary. This is administrative. It's not clinical. The survey of state medical directors averages anywhere from $50 to $80 an hour. We did do a survey of some of the larger EMS medical directors, trying to break down their wages based upon run volume. And I will just throw out kind of a general ballpark of what I have found in my research. And that was that it comes down to about $2 a run for a BLS service, $5 a run for an intermediate service, and about $10 a run for a paramedic service. And maybe more if you're doing a lot of critical care, interfacility transport stuff that you've got to do a lot of CQI on. And so, you know, charging by the hour, but, you know, if you get in today's economy, maybe economies of scale where you get a dozen BLS services in a county to come together and hire you together, and the sum total of those BLS services equals 500 runs, it makes it worth your while spend time to do that work, because it takes really about the same amount of time to review 10 runs as it does to do 40 runs, because just the time to dedicate the time to sit down and begin the work is really the biggest part of the day. You know, you understand what I'm saying, Dan, Dave?
Yeah, I haven't haven't heard it. Yeah, I just haven't heard it expressed in terms of a figure per run. I haven't heard that before. And I would agree with, you know, Chris, you know, attorneys and other, you know, professionals are earning generally substantially higher. But I'll tell you that $320 an hour is higher, substantially higher than our clinical hourly. And as I said, the clinical hourly for an emergency physician is the pinnacle of what, because working in an ED and seeing lots of patients and moving these people, that is stressful. It takes a lot, and that is sort of the peak dollar that for an emergency physician. So I agree with Dan and Keith that, you know, doing EMS for an emergency physician is much less stressful, unless you're in some hideous service where they're always in trouble. But most of them are not that. You know, so it's not worth the top clinical hourly for sure. I've heard figures people say, you know, $150 an hour, but that's based on no, you know, specific, you know, run makeup, or whether it's ALS, BLS, and I don't know. I would think somewhere between $100 to $150 an hour, depending on the service, and, you know, how busy you are. And again, what you can do there is adjust the number of hours so that, you know, you have two options as an agency, as a payer, and that is adjust the hourly and adjust the number of hours if you go that route.
Dr. Hankins, I wanted to say something.
Yeah, I would agree also. In fact, Dr. Fresconi in St. Paul did a study about 10 years ago. He looked at the cost of medical rejection per run. Actually came up with figures that are very close to Keith's. So I think he's right on the mark as far as that goes. It may be higher now because he did that study 10 years ago.
Wow. So, Dr. Ross, you should be making like $250 a year off AMR.
Well, that's a great question because let me see if I got – my math has never been good, guys. But if I take Keith's Keith's numbers of – I think I heard you say $10 a run for ALS runs or transport, I assume that means.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. Right.
So, you know, we do at AMR, we do 40,000 transports. The vast majority of them, I will say probably 90% of them are ALS, whether they deserve to be or not. So that would put me close to about 400K.
Yeah. I thought they were only 25,000, so there you go.
No. It's more than that. So I'm a little suspect. I'm thinking I probably am not going to get that amount of money from AMR. But
we are talking about AMR, right? Yeah.
I'm talking about AMR, 40,000 transports in Colorado Springs. But, I mean, you could take the same figures. I have other non-AMR agencies that do, 5,000-6,000 mostly ALS runs, a year. So, I mean, I could retire from clinical care and live fat, dumb, and happy, and I might be able to retire even before Dan does, or maybe I wouldn't want to.
Well, Dr. Ross, you brought up a good point a minute ago that said it should be, 85% of your clinical hourly is really the pinnacle of where you want to be in a clinical setting. But wouldn't you agree that being a medical director might be riskier than actually doing true clinical medicine? Because you are now overseeing at AMR, you're probably overseeing 300 or 400 paramedics and EMTs?
No, I have I have about 250 EMTs and paramedics.
Okay.
Altogether. And then I have other agencies that are non-AMR. I don't want to make this an AMR issue because it's really much broader. I have other ALS agencies that are outstanding agencies that are not AMR, and they each have about 25 or 30, employees in there. And then I have some volunteer agencies that are all BLS. And, I don't know how risky it is. I mean, it's pretty risky as an emergency physician. There are some things you can control in that clinical environment when you're seeing patients, but some things you can't. And it depends on how confident you are and how well-trained you think your crews are from your own experience, your QA, and whatever. And then the fact is that I believe across the country, and certainly within our system, the number of medical malpractice suits against EMTs and paramedics is actually quite small. And so the risk, I think, probably, at least in theory, is large because you've got these broad numbers of providers. But the actual fact is, I think, that the suits are quite, quite low. I don't know what you guys think, but...
Well, I think it depends on what role of medical direction you're doing. If you're a clinical medical director versus an operational medical director. If you're providing purely clinical medical direction and that you're writing medical care protocols and overseeing CQI, then I agree. Your risk exposure is low. But if you're an operational medical director where you're actually involved in employee remediation, hiring, firing, approving education, as well as operational deployment of the system, then your risk is higher, and if you're doing it on a contractual basis, you sure better have a good liability policy.
Well, that's true, and I think there is another component, that Keith brings up, and that is you shouldn't be directly involved in the hiring and firing of people, but the fact is that you make recommendations, and, if you just decide that, based on the evidence that this person shouldn't be practicing as a paramedic or needs to be suspended for a period of time, you make that recommendation to your operations manager, and it's not you directly doing that, but nevertheless, somebody who's angry might decide to sue, and so you do definitely need to understand that. That's an element that we don't experience clinically as emergency physicians normally. So you do have to kind of distinguish what the liabilities is. Not just medical malpractice. There's employee relationship issues and everything. But I've been doing this, you know, actively since 1996. And, I mean, knock on Formica here, I haven't been sued. I mean, and we've only had one malpractice lawsuit filed in all of those runs. I'm wow. probably asking for trouble.
Hopefully there's no attorneys that listen.
Yeah. It turned out Skip's not with us right now.
So no, he jumped off. I think he fell off his chair. So,
So my personal experience has been one of you know, very, very minuscule, you know, legal escapades. But, you know, that could change.
Okay, well, I thought it was just a point to bring up because I wanted to make sure that, you know, we were on the same page as far as you do oversee quite a bit, and you're right. There's things in your clinical practice you don't have control over, just as the same as the streets. And I know that there's not a lot of lawsuits against EMTs anyway. Most of the time, it's because they have a bad attitude. And those are things
came a long way from where we started with this this conversation of, you know, what is quality medical direction, and
right.
kind of ending up with what's it cost. And, you know, I think, and maybe this is probably worth another podcast, but it really comes back down to the lack of contracts. When I speak at conferences and people come up to me and go, "Boy, I wish we had a more involved medical director," my first question to them is, I say, "Well, what does your contract say?" And they say, "We don't have a contract."
Well, there you go. And you get what you pay for in the end.
Well, and even if you don't pay for it,
right.
you get what, you know, you wouldn't let anyone paint your house without a contract. You know, have a contract. Then you know what your responsibilities are and what their responsibilities are, and then no one's disappointed. That's the way you get quality medical direction.
Very good points. Well, we are very close to the end of this podcast. Any final words of wisdom or anything like that before we ride off into the sunset, as it were? All right. Well, Gary, thank you for joining us, sir. I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Hankins, thank you for joining us on such short notice. I really appreciate it. Hopefully you'll come back and we'll talk more about medical direction. And I really like this idea of really expounding upon what is a good medical director, because I honestly don't know. I know I have a good one right now, and I think he's a great guy, and he does a great job for us. But, you know, what is the quintessential person? What is their makeup? You know, is it somebody that's you know, out there looking at everything and wants to respond, so things like that. So thank you, Dr. Hankins. I appreciate it. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Dr. Ross, thank you, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure, as always.
And Dr. Wesley, thanks for writing the article.
Oh, you're welcome, Mike. I love doing it.
That's great. And we thank you, and thanks for joining us on the EMS Garage. This is episode 24, Medical Directors Galore. We'll see you next time on the... Oh, you know what we forgot to do? I forgot to do my advertisement, so we'll do that right now. Dan from EMS Manager, I'm going to give him a little bit of extra time here. EMSManager.net, sorry about that, Dan, and all the great guys over at EMS Manager. Please join us, or join them at EMSManager.net. And I got so excited about our guests and talking about medical direction that I completely spaced out talking about
sponsorship.
Hey, and they sponsor us well, and I can never forget that they do a great job for us. So emsmanager.net, I'm feverishly looking for Dave over at EMS Manager said, hey, say this week, because we're really excited about it. Optimize employee scheduling, improve efficiency and communications, save money, all with emsmanager.net. Go over there right now, get your free demo for 1 month, talk to Nate or Dave, and make sure that you tell them you heard it on the EMS Garage, and they'll hook you up with a great deal. So that's emsmanager.net. Thank you guys very much.
And Chris, remember to have everybody have their patients use that to schedule their emergencies. And then they'll have a lot more efficient operation.
Right. And buy Sharpies and say, cut this leg off first.
Yep. Oh, my goodness. Wait, you know, wouldn't that be great, though? That would be the ultimate in system status management, if you could actually come up with the ability for patients to schedule their emergencies. Or even the ability to schedule, you know, I think I'm going to get on the ladder today and hang Christmas lights. I'm just going to put that on the calendar.
That's right.
And
right.
Then the ambulance can be kind of circling like a piranha in the water.
Like a vulture overhead.
Exactly.
Are no accidents.
Okay, very good point. Well, are you sure? Just what's the corollary to that, Dr. Wesley?
They're crashes and fate.
Ah, excellent. Well, on that note, thank you guys. Thank you, EMSManager.net, and we'll see you next time on the EMS Garage.